Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We still have both James and Rick here with us. We are going to make the transition, however, to Yahweh's testimony, particularly regarding the covenant. Both men have affirmed something, though, that I do want to have continue into this second hour, or this third hour, which is that with Yahweh, if you want to come to know him, if you want to approach him, if you want to become part of his covenant family, if you want to be saved by him as a child of the covenant, there's only one path to that. It isn't through faith. Religion leads you in exactly the opposite direction. So it's not through religion. It's not through the content of your heart. It's not by being a good person. There's only one way to God. Only one place you can come to know him. And that is that you've got to observe, which means to closely examine and carefully consider what he has written in his Torah and prophets. And it's not just a matter of listening to what he had to say. It's not just a matter of reading what he has to say. It's a matter of closely examining, carefully considering it so that you, over time, transition from unaware to aware, which is knowing, and then from knowing to understanding before what he has to say is going to do you any good. And God consistently tells us that the path to him is based upon this process of observing, of coming to know as a result of that observation, and then of making connections so that we understand, and only after we understand, responding to him. So it is from eyes and ears through the brain, and then ultimately out through the mouth in terms of responding that this process works. There is no other path to God. So both men, having said that they did this cerebrally, is important for all of our listeners to understand. Go ahead, guys.
Now, that was kind of for me.
Go ahead. James, why don't you comment first, and then we'll listen to Rick.
Okay. Well, because it was along the line that that process was just 100% entirely intellectual. Yeah, I came to know to the undeniable knowledge that God exists. And then I came to know that, he revealed himself through this book we call the Torah, he called it the Torah, and through his prophets. And for me, it was this question of, now that I know this, I know there is a God, I know he revealed himself to man, what on earth could possibly be more important than coming to know and understand what that God had to say to us? And that's why I am where I am, is that pursuit, trying to know what God's revealed to us, trying to understand it better and better so that I know and understand him better.
Yeah, that was exactly my that was my approach as well, JV, is that once I came to recognize through the creation account and its accuracy, and then the flood account and its accuracy, and then the prophetic statements and their universal accuracy, that there was a 0% possibility that this wasn't inspired by a being who was not constrained in time as we are, that actually witnessed and participated in these things. Once you came to recognize that he proved his existence and that he proved his authorship of these materials, at that point, my curiosity was such that I wanted to go on a voyage of discovery. I wanted to find out and learn as much as I could from what he had to say. And then to try to understand it, bringing all the pieces together so I could celebrate what it was that he was offering. And that began as a journey about a little over a decade ago. Rick, go ahead.
Well, and I agree. And Yahweh's teaching is the perfect understanding that one would expect from a loving father.
Yes.
And it's validated throughout the Torah, and the it makes sense of the human existence that we have, and the covenant that also includes the Moed Mikre, which I did last year, and so grateful for it. That empowers the individual with the Ruach Kodesh, God's mm-hmm. spirit, God's set apart spirit,
mm-hmm.
and God being the creator of this reality, being mm-hmm. the creator of existence, the only rational explanation that the Torah is the only answer to the question of where it all came from. God gets something out of it too, because God created reality as we know it, the universe, the Big Bang, making mm-hmm. A non-temporal, non-spatial being having a personal influence upon something that didn't exist and something that was not even a non-spatial, non-temporal reality mm-hmm. giving birth to time and space is a personal intention, if you will.
Right.
And God's purpose is to have a relationship with his children, these other beings, i.e. us. And so that's where we celebrate with him. And yeah. it is a celebration, and it's freedom, and it's just so wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah, in fact, I haven't really thought about it in those terms, but here you have a being that where there is no concept of space or time, and no limitation on power. And that being creates a universe that, while it is massively powerful and massively spacious and essentially timeless from our perspective, from God's perspective, it's everything diminished. It's all of a sudden now there's a constraint on space. All of a sudden there's a constraint on time. All of a sudden that their energy is constrained to form matter. And so the God who wasn't constrained by any of these things created a universe that's constrained by all of them for the express purpose of engaging in this opportunity to have a relationship with us. It is it's a profound story. And James, you mentioned something earlier before we go to the first statement from his revelation, is that while you begin awed by the exactitude of the creation account and the precision of that creation account and the fact that it is precisely accurate as we understand the universe today and of life. And then you go to these countless predictions, these prophecies of what's going to occur and when they're going to occur. And all of a sudden you say, all right, this is really mind-numbing, profound kind of information. And while that is reassuring initially, ultimately, that's not where you're left. Somewhere along the line, you go from being wowed by the prophecies and the exactitude of the scientific presentation to, wow, this message is extraordinarily brilliant. This is God. This is predicting God. As presenting God as you would always want him to be. This is presenting the opportunity to come to know him in terms that is so welcoming, so logical, so lovable, so compassionate, so desirable, that all of a sudden it's the message that speaks more loudly than does the scientific account of the Big Bang, and more loudly than does the precisely accurate prophecies. It's the message itself that resonates.
Yeah, I mean, it starts off, you know, we were talking earlier, it starts off 100% intellectual. It's an intellectual pursuit. But, you know, if you ask me as it should be, you have to, stumbling over my words, but, you know, logic, reason, intellect is 100% necessary, but so is emotion in a relationship. But the emotion has to come from the logic. And it started off as a 100% logical and reasonable and intellectual pursuit, but you do come to know, once you come to know him in that intellectual way, you come to love God. You can't help it. You come to love his word and the magnificence of it and every little detail of it.
There is
an emotional response.
It is a brilliant transition. You know, my statement was that you go from being amazed by the scientific accuracy of the creation and the flood to the improbability of all of these exacting prophecies being fulfilled right before your eyes, to being amazed at the genuineness, the mercy, the approachable nature of this marvelous testimony of God regarding His covenant. And your point is the most important. All of this intellectual analysis leads ultimately to falling in love with the author. It's what happened with all of us. I fell in love with Yahweh. I think it's almost impossible for someone to have come to know Him as He presents Himself and to come to understand what He is offering and what He has done to enable His offer. It's darn near impossible to keep from falling in love. And so you do go through this process. The approach begins with complete skepticism, this willingness to question everything. And that skepticism leads to being open to the answers that God is providing. And that's an intellectual process that ends with an emotional result. You fall in love. You know, James, I would suggest to you, and you may share this conclusion, I know it's my own, that the smartest person that I have ever met through their writings is a fellow named Dode. We call him David, unfortunately, corrupting his name. And he wrote a number of songs. We call them songs. And one of them was a 176 statements going through the Hebrew alphabet letter by letter in alphabetical order with eight stanzas for each of the 22 letters. And it is a systematic and intellectual approach to how to properly observe the Torah. And as I was reading this, I said, this is the most brilliant mind that has ever existed in human history. And awesomely impressed with his intellect. And then ultimately, it just all boils down to, what was this guy's name? Beloved.
Dode.
Yeah, beloved. That's what Dode means, is beloved. And you could see his intellect ultimately, I mean, love. That he fell in love with the very God whose words he was studying, as have you, as have I, as has Rick. We'll be back with Shattering Myths after the commercial break. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. I definitely want to jump into Yahweh's testimony. His testimony means more than anyone else's. After telling us that his plan was to empower and enrich us to the greatest extent possible by way of his covenant, after telling us that his covenant was being given to us as a gift so that we would come to know and understand him and be able to appreciate the relationship he was offering with us, after telling us that he's going to grow right along with us and that by causing us to grow, that he, in fact, was going to grow, Yahweh concludes with this statement. And I will stand up and establish, with my familial covenant relationship, a means to recognize me and a source of understanding with regard to an association between me and between you, to help you understand and respond, and between your offspring, so that they might be observant and responsive after you. Regarding and on behalf of their dwelling places and generations, for an eternal and everlasting covenant relationship, to literally be and actually remain as your God and for your offspring after you. Bereshit 17:7. So, there's a couple of things that jump right out at me right at the beginning of this, James, and we'll get Rick's views subsequently. This idea that Yahweh says that he will kum, that he's going to stand up and establish with his family-oriented covenant relationship, that means to understand who he is and the means to properly respond to what he's offering. You're familiar, I'm sure, JB, with the campfire song Kumbaya. How does that relate to... Yeah, that's right, Stand With Yah. Well, how does that relate to this idea of God taking a stand to establish his covenant? How do you suppose he did that?
Well, that would be through fulfilling the Mikra of Pesach, Matzah, and Makurim.
Yes, and even Shavua.
And Shavua?
That what God is saying here is that for him saying, I'm going to take a stand, that's God saying, I am actually going to engage to make this covenant relationship possible. And where God specifically engaged, both in history and as an answer to his promise, was when he first demonstrated these first four Moed Mikre in the Exodus, saving his children from religious and political oppression in Egypt. The first four, again, just the first four, which were Passover is when their lives were spared. Matzah is when the religion and politics of Egypt was removed from the bread so that they would begin the process of appearing perfect, cleansed of religion and politics. And then they became adopted into God's family as his chosen people, being led towards the promised land. And en route, seven sevens after being adopted, he revealed the Torah on Mount Horeb to them, enriching their lives, empowering and enlightening them. Those same four Moed Mikre, weren't they played out in year 4000 Yah as well, 33 CE in our pagan calendars?
Yeah, wound up in full.
Right.
Exactly accurate.
And why do you suppose that Yahweh only fulfilled the first four in year 4000 Yah with Yahusha becoming the Passover lamb, with his soul going into Sheol, the place of separation on Matzah, with him having his soul and Yah's spirit reunited on firstborn children, and then seven sevens later, the fulfillment of the Shavua, with those who had participated in the first three Mikre being enriched and empowered by God's Torah teaching and his spirit. Why do you suppose it's just the first four both times?
Well, because the first four Mikre are the ones that, what's the word I'm looking for? I'm horrible with this on the spot, but facilitate the benefits of the covenant.
Well, that is the exact accurate answer. God is talking about he's going to take a stand in connection with the establishment of his covenant relationship. And it's those four, in using the term that Rick used earlier, Moed Mikre, those invitations to meet with God. It's those four that provide all five of the benefits of the covenant. And so that's why God said, I'm going to take a stand. I'm going to do these things. And he has, not once, but twice in the life of his people. And when we return to Shattering Myths, we'll get Rick's take on this and the rest of the statement that God has made. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. Rick, there's a transition here that as a former Christian, as someone who would probably be a questioning Christian just as recently as 2 years ago, Yahweh is saying that he's going to take a stand and establish his covenant relationship, and he's going to do so as a means for us to recognize him and to understand this association. As a Christian, is there any connection between this covenant and the stand that God took not once but twice to enable its benefits?
Well, first off, I'm not a Christian, and
no, I said as a former Christian.
There is no comparison. Christianity, in my perspective, is one big provable fallacy created by man. The stand that Yahweh established with his covenant is phenomenal. I have, yeah. You know, it's, I challenge anybody that has not read Introduction to God or Yada Yada or Questioning Paul to read at least one of those. And like you so eloquently articulated earlier, you won't come out of that unchanged and enlightened. And yeah. It provides all the answers to the mystery called life.
Yeah. What God is actually telling us is that he did take this stand on behalf of his covenant. And we see him doing it with the children of Israel during the Exodus, celebrating and walking us through these first four invitations to meet with them, as you referred to them by their Hebrew name earlier, Rick, by the Moed Mikre, which are invitations to be called out and meet with God. And then he himself, in a diminished corporeal form as Yahusha, enabled, facilitated each of these promises on these exact same dates. And yet in Christianity, in that wholesale fallacy, there isn't a single one of these dates of Yahweh's stand to enable the covenant's benefit. There's not one of them that they observe or celebrate. That's just it's such a shame. In fact, let's go one step further. In Christianity, the essence of Christianity is presented in a series of books called what? What would Christians, the Bible contains an old and a what for Christians?
A New Testament.
And the New Testament is based upon a new covenant, is it not?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's an illogical proposition.
Okay, so Yahweh here is saying that he's going to take a stand to establish his covenant. Did he say his covenants? Did he say, I'm taking a stand here to annul my covenant and then to establish a new one?
No, he didn't.
No. And did he end this by saying that his family-oriented covenant relationship was literally and actually going to remain forever as an eternal and everlasting covenant?
Yes.
So under that basis, under this basis, if you are to take the book of Genesis to be inspired, and Yahweh proved that he inspired it, isn't Christianity a wholesale repudiation of all of this?
Yep.
So yeah. If you were God and you took your people away from the most hideously religious and political place on earth through these first four meetings where you took a stand to establish your relationship, this covenant with them, and then you yourself took part of your energy and manifest yourself in a corporeal way to yourself be the Passover lamb. So you're having your soul go to the place of separation to fulfill the promises of Bukudim, firstborn children, and Shavuah, the enrichment and enlightenment and empowerment. It comes through the word and the spirit. And you had this whole popular religion that said, oh, the hell with that. We don't even like that old covenant. We want a new one. We don't want to pay any attention to any of the things that you did to establish this. The hell with Passover and unleavened bread and first fruits and weeks. We got a better idea. Our idea is the pagan myth of Easter and Christmas. If you were God, how would you view such people?
You know, it's kind of like in the Old Testament, when in the scripture, where Yah talks, the people of Israel wanted a king. They wanted to be like all the rest of these pagan nations.
Right.
And, they had God as their leader, but no, they wanted a king so they could be like everyone else. And that's kind of what Christianity is. We want the summer and winter solstice festivals like everyone else.
We'll
give them a Christian spin.
Right. Yeah, we want a God that can be feared so that everybody cowers. So we'll name our God the Lord, and we'll worship on Sunday because all religions worship on Sunday. And so what they did is they turned Yahusha into the embodiment of Tammuz, of Dionysus, of Osiris, of Bacchus, of all of the pagan death and resurrection gods. And every one of the death and resurrection gods, they modeled Yahusha after. And it just became this despicable conglomeration of lies. And but it's not. And I guess the point I wanted to make is that it would be one thing to be ignorant of what God has done, but it's another thing entirely to reject everything that he has done and to create an entirely contradictory version of it while pretending that you're serving, worshiping, speaking on behalf of that same God. And if I were God, I'd be mad as hell.
Well, it is the one thing he says he will not forgive.
Yes. I would be mad as hell. He has every right to be mad as hell. You know, if you're a Christian and you're taunting God by rejecting his covenant so that you could have a new one, and you're taunting God when it comes to the stand that he took to establish the benefits of this covenant by instead embracing pagan mythological traditions, you're not pleasing God. I don't care what your heart feels. I don't care how many people adhere to the lie. You're angering him.
And those people attempt to gain everything, their power, prestige, money, at the sake of losing their eternal salvation.
Correct. And you know, the other thing that's so interesting here is that Yahweh, through this covenant, through this Beirut, through this family-oriented covenant relationship, is focusing on the relationship and of how what he has done to establish it should appeal to our intellect so that we come to know him and understand what he is offering so that we can respond to him throughout the rest of time. He's speaking of a family-oriented relationship. And what are the Christians desiring? What are they focusing on? Relationship or salvation?
Salvation.
Right.
It's all salvation-centric.
Right.
That's why the heaven and hell myth is so beguiling.
Yeah, and when God speaks of his of the benefits of the covenant, he's really not speaking of salvation. He's speaking of making us perfect, making us immortal, adopting us into his family, enriching us with his teaching, and empowering us with his spirit. Now, those things collectively could be viewed as being restored, being improved, but God is not trying to bribe us with, pay attention to what I'm saying here and I'll save you. No, he's saying, pay attention to what I'm doing.
Salvation is only there because it's necessary for the relationship. We can't have a relationship with him.
Right.
Yeah, we have to be saved so we can continue this relationship with him. But, you know, it's a byproduct. It's there because it has to be, but it's not the focus.
But even as it relates to salvation, he's not using the term here, salvation. What he's using is the term, I'm going to enrich, I'm going to empower. What he's talking about here, you know, dads, when you raise children, you don't think of, I'm saving my children. You think of, I'm protecting my children. I'm nurturing my children. I'm teaching my children. I'm investing in my children so that I can enrich their lives. And that's what really God is focusing on here. Does that mean that by being perfected, that we are saved? Sure. But God is really even presenting that from a relationship concept. And, you know, the Christian mythology is that God's priority is to save. When God's saying here, no, my priority is this everlasting covenant relationship. That's my priority. And he's told us that as a result of that, we're going to become immortal and enriched and empowered and adopted. But boy, when you move to salvation and you bypass relationship and then you create an entirely different testament or covenant, you've missed everything that God is trying to convey.
Yeah, that's right. Salvation has the underlying connection to the Christian New Testament doctrine. And really what Yahweh is doing, God is doing, is lifting us up so that we
Correct.
Can walk with him.
Right.
And indeed, you're brought up and out of the conditions of life And once he recognizes that you make choice in the context of his teaching and understanding and relationship, then indeed you are lifted up.
All right. Relationship first. And then the benefits secondary. And the, you know, you accept the terms and conditions of the covenant because you've come to know God. By knowing Him, you come to understand what He's offering. You end up falling in love with Him. You want to spend eternity with Him. And as your Father now, it is His role to lift us up, to enrich our lives, to do all the things that a father wants to do for their children. And he comes to us not just as the Father, but also as the set apart Spirit, as our spiritual mother, because there's aspects of mothers and fathers in a home that are necessary to properly raise children so they get the benefit of both mother and father. It's one of the beauties of the Hebrew language. You mentioned it earlier, Rick, that the Ruach Kodesh, she is our spiritual mother. She is the maternal aspect of God's nature. And it is through our Heavenly Father and spiritual mother that we not only get to participate in this eternal family, but receive all the benefits that God is offering us through it. Welcome back to Shattering Mist. We're talking about this statement from Yahweh about how He's going to take a stand to establish His covenant. And that covenant is singular here, not covenants plural, which completely destroys Christianity. But JB, you've done a fair amount of study. The word that I translated, eternal and everlasting, olam, always enduring and eternally existing. Is there any way to describe olam, to translate olam as anything other than this covenant? From God's perspective, He is promising, He is committing, is going to exist forever?
No, the olam is without end, and there's no way to put a time limit on olam.
So Paul's point of view that this covenant only existed until God took a stand through the mythical Jesus is completely inconsistent with God's own testimony.
Yeah, there's no way you could have olam. Like I said, there's no time limit to olam. It is always enduring, eternal, everlasting. It's forever.
So how is that? Then how is it
olam olam?
So then how is it possible, Christians will protest, that in Jeremiah 31, God says that I'm going to create a new covenant, and that covenant is going to be different than the old one. How is that possible if God is saying this one and only covenant is going to be for all time, for all people, for all places, and for all of the covenant's offspring? How would you reconcile those things?
Can't. It's, you know, man mistranslating and corrupting Yah's word. He didn't say there was going to be a new testament or a new covenant. He said He was going to renew His covenant.
So what you've done here is you've looked at the word kadash, which is the word that has been translated errantly new, and what you found is that the verb, which defines nouns in Hebrew, the action form of the word, is properly translated renew, reaffirm, restore. Is that what you're telling me?
And exactly. It's most commonly used with the cycle of the moon and the renewing of the moon.
Right. In fact, it happens to be the Hebrew word for month because of the renewal of the light on the moon's surface. So what God is saying then is not that He's going to create a new testament, but that He's going to restore and reaffirm and renew this one and only covenant.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're probably familiar with that the statement in Yeshaya 31, when God said that it's going to be different, did He mention how it was going to be different? Did He quantify what the difference was going to be?
There is only one difference, and that is that the Torah will be written upon our hearts.
So God says that He's personally is going to integrate His Torah teaching into our lives.
Mm-hmm. That is the only difference mentioned.
Okay, so how could there be, Rick, a Christian New Testament that repudiates the Torah and annuls the Torah, if in fact when the covenant is finally renewed and restored, God is going to integrate that very same Torah into our lives. How would that be possible?
It's not possible. It's man-made stuff.
That's true. It's, in fact, to hold the position that there can be a Christian New Testament that annuls the Torah, that repudiates the Torah, that replaces the Torah with a gospel of grace, is completely contradictory to God's own testimony, is it not?
100%.
So you have to either be ignorant of God's testimony or irrational, therefore, to be a Christian. Is that where this leads us?
Yes. You cannot be rational or informed and be a Christian.
Christianity leads to irrationality.
Yeah. And on the other side here, what Yana was saying is that I'm offering you this covenant. The purpose of this covenant is to enrich and empower your lives. It's based upon the concept of family. I'm going to be your father, and I'm going to allow you to inherit a number of things. And those things that you are going to inherit are immortality. You're going to inherit perfection, so I'm going to view you as perfect. I'm going to make you perfect. I'm going to adopt you into my family. I'm going to enrich and empower you. That what God is saying here is that those promises are for all time and for everyone in every place that wants to participate. Isn't that what God is telling you here?
Yep, he is. And there's not a separate path if you're a Gentile. There's only one path. Gentile, Jew, whatever. It doesn't matter. That is the path.
Didn't, in fact, God say in the previous two statements that this family-oriented relationship was being established with Goyim, with all people from all races? So it sounds like God's testimony is clear, consistent, and therefore dependable. Thank you guys for both for participating. We'll be back with you on Monday.